From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, one view of how big cuts to the UW system budget could have an impact on research happening at UWM. Later, a Milwaukee production of Otto Fugard's The Train Driver is an eye-opener about race relations everywhere.
It's a really great example of stepping into another person's world and having your eyes open that all those assumptions that you had made about those people, whatever those people are, all those assumptions just come crashing around you.
And the end of an era, a go-to store for Milwaukee artists, is getting ready to finish a 79-year run of knowing everybody's name.
One of our customers had said, her granddaughter said to her, well, you can just buy your art supplies anywhere. You could buy them online. And she said, no, you don't understand. Artist on Display was the Cheers of art supply store.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Good morning. Thanks so much for tuning in today. As the battle over right to work reaches a flashpoint in Wisconsin's state capital, the debates over parts of the governor's proposed state budget have barely begun. At university campuses around the state, department heads are going into their own budgeting processes, contemplating cuts that could be as small as 5% or as large as 20% or more. The state budget proposal currently calls for $300 million in reduced state aid over the next 2 years. At UW-Milwaukee, one leading researcher is considering how the cuts might affect the ability of he and his colleagues to continue their work. David Petering is a university distinguished professor of chemistry and biochemistry, and he's with us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The cuts that are proposed to the UW system, it's a lot of money, $300 million. It seems not unreasonable to say it would hit a lot of departments and a lot of work being done within the system to a significant degree. Would you say, do you think the impact to research would be any worse than in any other part of the system or pretty well spread across?
I think one has to understand that when we're talking about the cuts to the system is comprised of a number of different institutions. So I really have to speak about UW-Milwaukee. UW-Milwaukee is one of the two research doctoral universities within the University of Wisconsin system. Its whole program really is predicated upon having a faculty that is intimately and intensively engaged in research. So when one starts talking about $300 million in cuts for the system, that means $40 million in cuts for UWM if it's done proportionally. That's a lot of money at UWM. UWM has a lean budget already, and that's because the university system has been cut and cut and cut over the years and over the decades. So to come all of a sudden to the largest cut that has ever been imposed and couple that with the inability to raise tuition, which is the trade-off that is always done in states. If states lower their support, then the agreement is that in order to keep the institution going and to keep it healthy and have a quality program, then they get to raise tuition. But what's happening is that for the past 2 years, we've had flat tuition, which has been a killer. And this is going to be perpetuated. So now you couple the cuts with also the inability to actually do anything about them. And inevitably, as Regent Charles Pruitt said to the UW-Milwaukee Faculty Senate this past week, you're going to lose quality.
You mentioned that the idea that that flat tuition is a killer, and I mean this is one of those things that we hear, and at the same time that we probably imagine that the public hears flat tuition and they think, well, this is a good thing. I can afford to send my son or daughter to college in Wisconsin without worrying that tuition will be a killer to us. It's got to be a fine line for people who depend – their livelihood depends on the ability to, you know, raise tuition to tell people that tuition needs to go up.
University of Wisconsin used to operate within sort of a state agreement that tuition levels would be kept low. Historically, tuition within the UW system has been rock bottom within peer universities. If you compare Madison with, for example, with the rest of the Big Ten, you'd find that their tuition is quite low. At some point in time, this began to change, and so the you might say the agreement among the people of Wisconsin that we wanted to have a strong, indeed, one of the best systems of higher learning in the country, and that you have to pay for these sorts of things. Then that began to fray a little bit, and so you have to do something under those circumstances. Students understand this. The president of the UW-Milwaukee student government himself understands. Sure, students would like to have who would not like to have services not increase in cost and so forth. But the reality is that those sorts of things have to occur if you want to maintain the quality of the system. You have to remember what's at stake here. If you just think about this in dollar terms, and really that's the smallest way to think about it. But nevertheless, those people who go to the university over their lifetime are going to earn on an average of $1 million more than those who only get a high school education. So this is an investment by this generation and the next generation. And if we don't think about it that way, then we end up in situations like we have right now.
What about the idea that the university would eventually have increased flexibility or autonomy or the opportunity to raise tuition in the years to come? This is 2 years out.
You probably have been looking at the newspapers like I do, and of course that has been put on the table that in 2 years we would be a public authority with our right to raise our own tuition. And so somebody points out, well, if you get a $300 million cut now, you're going to have to raise tuition a lot after that. What's the immediate response? We've heard it from the legislator. We've heard it from the governor. Well, I'm not so sure we should actually let them just raise tuition as they like. We would have to have controls on it. So this so-called autonomous public authority begins to lose autonomy, and so it's unclear actually what would happen. But the issue about that is that what you're doing now is you're cutting to the core of the university, whether it's UW-Milwaukee or whether it's Madison or whether it's these other institutions and so forth. Once you cut, it takes a long time to rebuild that. It isn't as if just 2 years later you add some money back and all of a sudden you're restored. It takes years, decades to build a strong university as we've done it at UW-Milwaukee. And this can come apart very easily once you lose that ability. I'd have to say one more thing about this, and that is that the public authority notion that you would convert the UW system to a public authority is not only about sort of these abstract notions of autonomy and efficiency, which, by the way, is pretty vague at this point, but it goes to things like how we govern ourselves within within the university and the UW system and so forth. Right now, we are very pleased to have a shared governance system where administrators and faculty work together. We're also pleased to have tenure, which is an extremely important aspect of having strong research universities. Both of those things actually have been crossed out of the operating document of the University of Wisconsin system, and it would be up to the public authority to decide should they be put back in. Nobody knows whether they would be. There are a lot of statements which are easy to make right now to say, oh, sure, we're just going to carry this over. But actually, faculty are quite skeptical of what's going to happen.
Could you give us maybe some examples, either you know within the work that you do or others within the within UW-Milwaukee, the kinds of research work, the impact that these cuts might have on projects that are already underway?
Well, I would say if you talk to my colleagues in the chemistry department, what is the worst problem that we have faced actually for a long, long time, and it will just get worse, is the fact that we cannot pay our graduate teaching assistants a competitive stipend to come to UW-Milwaukee. What that means is that we cannot compete for the best students to come here to be part of research projects, number one. We cannot compete for the best students to be teachers because, after all, these teaching assistants are assisting faculty in teaching various courses to students who come here. Right now, the TA stipends, teaching assistant stipends, are at least 25% out of the range of even being competitive. So we just see this getting worse, and we don't see a way out of that. That's not something that we can solve by working harder. That's part of a budget issue. So that's certainly one of the big things that comes into play. I'll tell you another big one in the chemistry department, and that is our building's falling apart. Now, we really didn't realize how badly it was falling apart. But all of a sudden, various inspections showed that actually it's in pretty bad shape. To the extent that some facing structures had to be replaced because they were so poorly attached to the building. And all of a sudden, the chemistry department sees itself at the top of the list of new building projects for UW-Milwaukee. We have no clue in a public authority how that would be paid for, to be honest. There just is no concrete detail about how a public authority would work budgetarily. So this notion of just converting us and everything will work out fine leaves people who are trying to do their best within within the university for both teaching and research in a position of great uncertainty.
There have been some who have said that in the absence of state dollars, more could be done through private fundraising or efforts to secure more grant dollars, either federal or otherwise. Is there some truth to that? Do you see any ability to make up some of the difference through fundraising efforts?
I know people say this, but let's understand state dollars – our particularly base budget dollars, what we call base budget dollars, come every year. So once it's in your budget, you have that coming every year, except for, of course, when they're cut. If you're fundraising, that's one time. So, for example, I have a pre-college education grant right now, which is up for renewal. That grant has a yearly budget of $250,000 a year. Okay, that goes for 5 years, and during that period of time, I'm going to get $250,000 every year. Well, we're not sure it's going to get refunded, so we're trying to hedge our bets, and we're looking at private foundations. And you take a look at private foundations, well, they might give you $250,000 for a winning proposal. That's for 1 year. All right. Now, the next year, we have to go back to a foundation, compete again, and see whether we can get that sort of funding. It's really very difficult to fill in dollars from the state with these sorts of things. That being said, obviously, if you're in the sciences and engineering and so forth, one of your responsibilities really is to bring in extramural funding. So, for example, I know I might be a little bit of an outlier here, but I probably rank number one at UW-Milwaukee, and I brought in more than $30 million over the time I've been at UW-Milwaukee. And that's just my responsibility. And all of us who are in the chemistry department, for example, are continually sending out proposals. And we have a very high percentage of our faculty in the chemistry department who do have grant money. The issue at UW-Milwaukee is that we're so small. So if you take a look at the faculty, probably only 150 of the 700 or so faculty that we have actually are in a position to compete for substantial extramural funding. That's just a very small number of people. And it's really a reflection of the fact that the number of faculty we have per student is among the smallest in the country among research universities. Why is it small? Because UW-Milwaukee has not been funded like a research university over the years. We have, in a way, built a remarkably strong program with sweat equity. But now you want to say, okay, I'm going to add another $40 million in cuts to all of this. You have to remember that's coming out of state dollars. State dollars go to pay salaries. So you're simply undercutting both the faculty base for teaching, but also the faculty base for doing research and for garnering extramural funding. The numbers just unfortunately inevitably crunch toward that way. If you want to have a major research operation and so on, there has to be an investment in faculty who can do this sort of thing.
Given what's going on between those who would fund the university or reduce its budget in this case and the university itself, if you were talking to either a sharp high school student or an undergraduate who is considering doing their graduate work, would you encourage them still to come to UWM?
Now, that's an unfair question, right? The fact is that UW-Milwaukee, and I've been here a long time, and honestly, I know lots of people around the campus, and I can tell you we have really a stellar faculty. I'm a distinguished professor. I see the letters that are being written for people that are being brought up for distinguished professor, and I'm blown away. Letters come back saying this is the best person in his or her field. I look at somebody in our own department who's coming up for tenure, like this past year, Kristen Murphy, who runs our general chemistry program. She's described as one of the best young chemical education researchers in the country. That's in 20 letters that we got back, and over again, that's what we saw. People have a great deal of loyalty for one reason or another to being in Milwaukee, to being at the university, and to want to see it succeed. That's why there is so much concern, and there's a good deal of frustration and actually anger about what's going on here, because basically this is all being done without a plan. Nobody knows what's going to happen with $300 million in cuts. There is no plan. There is no budget for a public authority that says this will work. People think that somehow we will live off the sales tax, which a lot of people have pointed out is a very uncertain tax for funding in the future. There are a lot of issues there. That being said, students who come and who work with me and who work with other people that I know get very good educations. They get opportunities to do undergraduate research. If they're graduate students, they end up getting jobs, or they end up going on to postdoc positions. One of my students, just a stellar student, Drew Nowakowski, is now at Northwestern University. We're working with one of the top people in the world in the field that he's interested in. And I have no doubt that he will end up in a very good academic position when this is over for him at Northwestern. That sort of thing is there because we're all willing to work for it. So I'd say students should still come. But I would say to the students, this is your fight, really. Do you want a university that is the highest quality that it can be and offer you as much as it can for your future? And if you do, then you're going to have to be part of the discussion about does it make sense what we're doing in this budget.
David Petering, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
David Petering is University Distinguished Professor of Chemistry and Biochemistry at UW-Milwaukee. You can find all of our coverage of the debate over Governor Walker's biennial budget at WUWM.com. A break now, and then we'll speak with the two stars of a Milwaukee Chamber Theater production that's set in South Africa, but we'll have people thinking about race everywhere. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Thank you. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. South African playwright Atul Fugard has written some great and important plays in his long career. His work has, in a sense, been a chronicle of the turbulent relations between races in that country as it has evolved through the second half of the 20th century into the 21st. Fugard's latest work will get its Midwest premiere in Milwaukee this week. The Train Driver is inspired by a true story of a railroad man searching for the identities of a mother and child accidentally killed by his train. Milwaukee Chamber Theater's production of The Train Driver opens this evening. The two-man cast stars David Daniel and Michael Torrey, who joined Lake Effect's Bonnie North, and talked about what makes Fugard's work so important to them.
For me, the power of Fugard is in his relationships, the relationships between the characters on stage and his relationship that every character has to whatever is going on in their life. And so this particular piece, I suppose you could say – it would be very easy to say that his plays have a lot to do with race, and I know that to be true. But I grew up in Virginia in the South, and the race question is still very much alive and still being pursued and asked and trying to be answered. But for me, the biggest part of this play, the strongest, what really drew me to it was the idea of class. It's always separation. It doesn't matter if it's separation because of religion or skin color or how much money you make, but there'll always be some separation. And that separation, out of that separation comes ignorance. Oh, I know how it is for them. If only they would just, you know, just why don't you just get a job? There's always that kind of opinion that grows up and is nourished in ignorance where I know about my life, so I must know about yours. And I think this play is it's a really great example of stepping into another person's world and having your eyes open that all those assumptions that you had made about those people and whatever those people are, all those assumptions just come crashing around you when you realize that they're human beings in extraordinary circumstances and that if you're lucky, you would do half as well as they are doing in their circumstances. So personally, for me, the play deals a lot with class and the assumptions that we all have about that group of people or that group of people. And I have found it motivating. It's encouraging to me, even though the play may not end that well for the characters in it. It encourages me to step outside of where I am, where I live, and look into the lives of other people that I assume I know all about.
Until you find out that you don't.
Yeah.
Yes. And so we kind of set this – let's set this up a little bit. You play Rolf, David, and you are an Afrikaans.
Yes.
And you are coming to, Michael, your place, and Simon is
– Well, Simon is the caretaker, if you will, of the graveyard where they bury the nameless people. So those black South Africans that have died and no one knows their name, nobody has claimed their body, they go to this graveyard to just be buried anonymously. And I'm the caretaker of that graveyard. And in my own way, even though I don't know who they are, I mark the graves so that I know, well, I buried someone here and, you know, I need to make another spot for the next person type of thing. And when Rolf, or as Simon fondly calls him in the play, Rufy, when he comes into his world, part of his frustration is trying to locate the particular grave in which he's looking for.
Now, do you feel that Simon is also learning something about Rolf's life that he didn't know about? Because certainly Rolf is learning about Simon mm-hmm. and Simon's world.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Oh, yes. You know, Simon, they come at each other from such different places. And, you know, one of the directions that Michael Wright, our director, has given us is when they first meet, they are almost like two dogs trying to figure each other out. And then out of that comes an understanding, if you will, of each other, especially for Rolf. And then for Simon, too, that this guy is not so bad. He's interesting. I have learned something from him. And out of that, there is this unique relationship, I will call it. We can't call it necessarily a friendship. We can't call it, you know, a buddy play, if you will. But
right,
there is
not
an
really
understanding.
Comrades, yeah.
Yeah, but it's an understanding at which point they reach. So,
yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, it's like all art. It's so subjective and it depends on where you are at that time when you meet the piece. But for me, I find it I find it to be a very uplifting ending. And I'm sure most of the people who are going to watch the show are going to go, no, I don't.
that
maybe
matters.
That was a different play you were
He's
reading.
Mad.
Yeah,
He's
but I
mad.
Find, and I go back to the idea of class or race, that he's a writer. Foucault is a brilliant writer, and he knows that these kind of changes that a human being would go through, a life change, they don't come about on a Tuesday. They don't come about when you're having coffee and then you turn to the table beside you and there's someone who's different and you strike up a conversation. It takes extraordinary circumstances to break down the walls that you have built up for so many years and your understanding of what life is, what you think life is. And so he's created these incredible circumstances for this man, Rolf Asahi. And he just provides him with that opportunity to make the change. I don't know. I was talking to someone about this earlier. I don't know if I would have the strength to make the change that Rolf does, because he absolutely changes his idea of what the world is like. That's extraordinary. And so I think the play ends I think it ends well, because there's a human being who said, I am absolutely sure that this is what life is about. And by the end of the play, by the end of his journey, he's been confronted with other human beings and he changes his worldview on that. And I think that's extraordinary.
I think most of us don't change that easily.
Right.
Yeah. And we don't want to. We like our ideas, even if we don't know we have them.
Right.
We're comfortable.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to add to that, it's just so amazing that he takes these circumstances, because this is based on a true story, and he has taken the story and I believe it took him some years to finally put it down on paper. He knew this incident happened. It took him years to process it, put it down on paper, and come up with this viewpoint for the play. And it is just interesting that all of the, you know, art imitates life. So he has taken actual events in life and formed this beautiful play to speak to us, you know, the masses, so that hopefully we can take that journey with Rolf and hopefully in our own way find resolution, find understanding.
Or at least have our eyes open.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And that's all it takes. I mean, sometimes that's all that art can provide you, whether it's a dance or a piece of music or a piece of art on the wall. It just something opens up and it gives you the opportunity. You're the one who has to step through. You're going to have to find the courage to step through and be something different. But that's all that we can ask of art, is that it just gives us the opportunity to step into something greater than what we already are.
What are some of the challenges for the two of you as actors, talking in craft terms now? I mean, David, you have most of the lines. I mean, there's times when it felt like it was almost a monologue. And Michael, you have to – you're reacting to a lot of that.
Yes, constantly.
Yeah.
You know, David does have long passages within the play and – you could think, oh, well, he's got time off. But actually, I don't, because I have to journey with him. I have to listen to him go through this process. And in so doing, I'm going through the process with him. So therefore, the understanding comes, you know, from two totally different ways, but that understanding comes together. And, it's an interesting journey, because there is no time off really for either one of us. Yeah,
I think it's easier to imagine that when you have a speech, a monologue, a soliloquy, that there must be some craft. You must craft it in some way, and have your highs and lows, and how this thought leads to the other. And I think it's less easier to imagine the listening of that, the listening to that, and that takes just as much craft as anything else, because. Michael has to know He has to know my rambling thoughts that Fugard has given him. He's got to know him just as well as I do, because he's got to respond in just the right way to help prompt me to say the next thing. I have to look into his eyes and see that he understands. I have to look into his eyes and see that he doesn't understand, and please do this one time. And so he crafts his listening just as much as I craft my speaking. And it's a hard job.
Yeah. Yeah. And at some point, you have to realize as the character that you're on this journey too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because as you go through it, you know, as David was just saying, his words prompt my reactions. And in so doing, it does prompt the words that I do speak and everything, because they are questions to him to hopefully have my character understand what he is saying and what he's going through.
And it also prompts your actions too.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it once or twice. At the end of the play, we're interested where Simon ends up and what he has learned. And it's curious to ask that at the end of the play, and I can't wait for a talk back, but to find out if the audience thinks that Simon stepped forward, stepped up, stepped out of where he was before into something new, or if he has stepped back. So it's just a curious question.
Yes. And Fugard leaves it kind of open.
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does leave it where an audience can interpret, mm-hmm. you know, what happens. And certainly the actors can. Mm-hmm. You can make decisions. And I wonder if that might not change each time you do it. Over the course of the run, you'll have things pretty much set, of course, but you'll have things that move and evolve and change because it has to.
And that's one of the worst parts about acting.
Yeah.
I'm not kidding, Michael. I were laughing about it yesterday. We both know, having done this for many years, that the last two, three, last performance, we're going to look at something and go, oh, why? Oh, after all this time, that's
now
how I
figured
should've
it
been.
Out.
Now I know how to say it. And it's maddening. Yeah. It's maddening. It's maddening. You feel like if you could have started there, then you're just getting at something rather than, oh, this is where we ended up. And somehow it just feels so frustrating at times.
But, you know, that's such a perfect description of what this play is asking us to do too.
Yes.
You know, that you never get it.
Right.
All you can do is keep trying.
That's right.
And I'm like, David, I can't wait until that first talk back, because I know that there are going to be two or three different viewpoints where a person goes, well, I saw this. And the other person goes, how in the world did you see that? I saw this. And it's just going to be interesting to hear what they take away from that.
Does that feed into your future performances once you've kind of got things set and you have a talk back and you take in what audience members are saying? Does that inform you going forward?
We're certainly not going to change anything.
Like rethink.
Yeah,
the
we're not going to rethink
that.
We're not
going
to rethink that. But I won't say no to that.
I just wondered, because talkbacks are such an important part of most theaters' experiences now. You know, they want to hear what audience – and I wonder how that affects actors, you know, once you've got a performance kind of gelled.
Well, for me, that's the whole point of doing the play. My mother and father were actors, and they grew up in the 60s at doing plays in church basements and coffee houses. And afterwards, the most important part of the play happened, which was the discussion. And people were talking about the plays, not about the actors. Oh, you were so good in your part and I love the costumes. But they were talking about, I disagree. I don't think the government has a responsibility. So it was that kind of arguing. And for me, that feeds that's exactly what theater is for, which I believe is why I love Fugard so much, because his plays are about those conversations that we have. And so the talkbacks for me are exactly why I do the play, so that we can have conversations that we would not have had otherwise. So he presents this drama for us, and as it unfolds, we become emotionally tied, not logically, not rationally. No, we're emotionally tied to it. And afterwards, we're all churned up and we have to speak about that and get it out, and we learn from each other. And I don't know that I'm going to change anything, but I do know that that strengthens my resolve in what it is that I do as a professional.
Ditto. I will add that.
Yes. Well, I am very much looking forward to hearing, you know, what people think about this, because it is, again, such a powerful play. Very much looking forward to seeing the both of you in it. And I want to thank you for coming in and talking a little bit about it today.
Oh, thank you very much for having us.
It's been our pleasure. Thank you.
David Daniel and Michael Torre star in Milwaukee Chamber Theater's production of Atul Fugard's The Train Driver, which opens this evening at the Broadway Theater Center's Studio Theater. That's in the Third Ward. It runs through March 15th. They spoke with Bonnie North. A mainstay of the Milwaukee art world is in its last few weeks of existence. We hear about the end of an era on West Burleigh Street when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Of Lake Effect now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. We've introduced you to many artists around the Milwaukee community over the years. Their works are contemporary or abstract or owe a great debt to great painters who came before them. But one of the realities that has united many disparate parts of the Milwaukee art community has been a place that many artists for years have gotten their supplies, from paints to pens to brushes to canvases. If you've ever driven on West Burleigh Street out by Mount Mary University, you've probably seen the giant paintbrush and pencil that support the sign for artist and display. Within a few weeks, that sign will be gone, and the last of the store inventory will reside in the studios of artists around the area. Before that piece of Milwaukeeana disappears forever, we traveled out to Artist and Display to meet one of the people who has helped make it a destination for a long, long time.
My name is Nora Hackenberg. I'm creative director at Artist and Display.
And how long have you been doing that?
Oh, probably over 40, 45 years. I can't remember because we just sort of, my sister and I both sort of morphed into the business. When she married my brother-in-law, I was still in art school. And when he married her, he was lucky enough to get me.
Well, start from the beginning. How did this store happen to be where you ended up?
Well, it started in 1936, and my brother-in-law Jack Klein's grandfather started the business when he retired from his fruit and vegetable business. He started it with two sons and a son-in-law. It's Artist and Display because at that time it was display materials. Department stores had corrugated cardboard, signage, and things like that. Jack decided he would get involved in the business when he left college. He moved the store then to our Blue Mount location in the 60s. And then in the 80s, we moved to the location here on Burleigh.
So when did the business morph from being largely about retail displays to the kind of supply for artists that it really has turned into?
Well, they had a lot of art supplies on Wisconsin Avenue, which was our first location right across from the library. It's been, since they left, it's been an open parking lot. They had a lot of art materials there because I can remember going down there with my father, who I grew up drawing and painting with, not knowing I would end up living at Artist and Display. When he moved it to Burleigh, there was a much stronger fine art materials selection. And then when my sister and I got involved in the business, it really became a lot of design items and other things like that too. So we were pretty unique in art supply stores.
And along those lines, when you are an art supply store, you're never, I assume, really separate from the community you serve. You're really a part of the community that you serve, right?
Oh, absolutely. I have an MFA degree in drawing and painting, and so I've always been a part of the community. We felt that really all we wanted was one store that would be a great store, to be a locally supplying store. That's why we had free demonstrations all the time. We did a great class venue. And that was very important to us because we felt we just didn't want to sell materials. We wanted to show people that everyone is creative. Some people need to find it a little, you know, it's a little harder for them to find, but everyone is inherently creative. And we wanted to be there for the people that weren't quite sure of what they wanted to do.
Tell us how the decision came along to end the run.
Well, there were three events that happened together. The lease was up on the building. We've never owned the property. My brother-in-law is 74 years old. He's third-generation owner. Most people retire before 74. And then in my family, our younger brother died at 60 last year, and that gave my sister and I a real wake-up call. She's 70, I'm 68, and there's quite a few things that we would like to do.
And those are the kinds of things that you really probably can't do when you're spending so many hours a week at a store like this.
Yes, we work 7 days a week. So there was never any downtime to do anything else. Our vacations were trade shows, which we loved. But you do need some personal time at some point, and especially as you get a little older.
How closely did you feel connected to the other artists, the people that used this store all the time?
Oh, we've become personal friends of many, many people, and that's what's going to be really hard for us. I mean, we'll still stay in contact with a lot of people, but we realize we're leaving a lot of people lost, and I have to come to the realization of where am I going to buy my art supplies too? So I'm trying to stockpile as many as I can. It is a family store. Your customers are family too, and I have to say we had the most fabulous customers. Some people that would come in every Saturday and Sunday for our free demonstrations, they were really a part of our family.
What are the kinds of things that you're hearing from them as this as the business has been winding down?
Oh, it's been they're very happy for us, but they're very sad also for themselves, which is, you know, understandable. We do have a sketchbook in front, and people have been writing goodbyes to us or doing little drawings in them. We had one man that said, oh, I told my son that you're closing, and he cried, and he's 9 years old. You know, because it's just a special place.
We were talking before we turned the microphone about how this is perhaps emblematic of the way retailing is going, that there are fewer stores like this where you can go and browse for an hour or two and also take a class or see a demonstration. Has it been hard being someone who has been so immersed in a physical retail world to see how the retail world has changed around you?
It has, because I've always loved shopping. It's been a true adventure for me, and the experience of finding new things, getting ideas. Whenever we go to any trade shows out of the city, we try to go into as many retail stores as possible. And we see in other cities small stores that were our favorite stores disappearing too. You know, unfortunately, I think what's happening is everyone wants to shop in a big, 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 big store. And you lose your identity and you lose that continuity of knowing that you're going to see the same people. Our employees, most of them have worked over, you know, 20, 25 years, 30 years for us. So when customers come in, they saw the same people and they knew that they would see them.
At the same time, though, this story of this store closing is different than many in that it's not the competitive pressures that are putting you out of business.
Right. We've been very lucky that we're able to leave on our own terms. And really, the three events that happened are why it's time. I mean, as I called it, a trifecta. If you didn't leave at this point, you know, you'd be really losing in something, you know, for your own quality of life.
I don't know anything about your artwork, but I wonder if the experience of this business wrapping up as it is at all inspiring your artistic output.
Well, I'm really excited about having some time to do some art. And you probably don't know it, but the store is also tied in with our boxer dogs. We've always had boxers as a family. We're on our sixth puppy.
I think I could hear one.
You could hear him, yes, yes. He's a little boy, very much of a little boy. And I think a lot of my art is going to morph into doing a lot of things, you know, with him. And I've had the great experience of being able to try every kind of art supply possible and also touring all the different manufacturers throughout the world. So, yes, that'll have a really big impact once I get the time to start working again.
Talk about some of the places that you've had a chance to visit and the things you've had a chance to do, even as you haven't been able to take a true vacation.
Well, you know, for me, a vacation is active. I'm not the kind of person that could ever go to a beach and sit there. We've gone to England. We've toured manufacturers, Winsor & Newton & Company. We've gone to Holland and toured manufacturers, paint manufacturers there. We've been to Egypt. Our National Art Materials Trade Association would have great trips after the big conventions, and it really sort of solidified friendships between both manufacturers and other retailers because you were always talking business, even though you were in a different location. We've been to Japan, to China. It's really been a great time. I would have never been able to have gone to all those places if I wasn't involved in the retail.
Do you think the manufacturers appreciated that there was a real human being that they were dealing with? As opposed, I mean, obviously, you started this well before there were massive websites where people could buy this stuff. But the being able to deal with a store as opposed to, you know, a faceless entity that's just buying product.
Oh, absolutely. Because at that time, most of the manufacturers were family owned too. And so you really forged a friendship with them. If you had a problem, you could always call and talk to the people that were in charge. So it was an era that was different. So many of the art material manufacturers now, some of the really big ones, are owned by big conglomerates. It's not the same as the people that are actually making their living, you know, selling paint. And they make paint, and they want you to be the best artist that you can be, and they're there for you. It's not just making sure that their stockholders end up with a good bonus.
It must be a little surreal to come to work every day and see a little less on the shelves each day.
Yes, and also talking to people. I mean, it's very difficult sometimes to get what you wanted to get done during the day because people want to say, oh, they're really going to miss you, or what are they going to do now? And so you have to really reassure them and say, you know, we're trying to find some other sources for you. But what's really wonderful is most of the people are just very supportive. They understand why we're leaving, and they would probably be leaving in the same situation. But it's still very bittersweet.
Was there ever any thought to seeing if there was a buyer that wanted to take this over?
Well, it's very difficult because we don't own the property, so you don't have a space to sell. We would never sell our name because truly no one's going to be as crazy as we are to do the things that we would do. And so if someone really was dying to open up an art supply store, hey, they can. You know, so, and there aren't any children in the family to continue on. So they're really, it's the end of an era.
I think the question that anyone who has driven this stretch of Burleigh will undoubtedly be wondering is what will happen to the giant paintbrushes?
The giant paintbrushes won a couple of national awards, as did our neon signs too. I don't know of any other store that embraced, you know, a commissioning artist to do things like that.
Tell us about that. For people who don't necessarily spend any time in this side of the city, talk about the giant paintbrushes and the neon signs.
Okay, the giant paintbrush, when we moved into the property, we subleased from Century. And so that had been pylons with a big sign that said Century. We were in the building because in those days, stores weren't open on Sunday. So we moved the store from the old location Friday night, Saturday, and then Sunday, and we opened up on Monday. So we were just basically closed on Sunday. We moved in. It was operational, but it wasn't really finished. So Tony Stenzel from Dursey at the time had come in. We had gotten to know him quite well. And he said, Nora, what are you going to do about your outdoor sign? And I said, Tony, I can't even think of that right now. We're trying to do the interior. And he said, well, I've got some ideas. So he came up with a drawing, and originally he had a marker and a technical pen, and I said, I love the idea because what's happened is there's just two fiberglass sheaths over those big pylons. And I said, but it's got to be more universal. We'll do a paintbrush and we'll do a pencil. And that was it. So they're fiberglassed. I think that the tips are going to be in my sister and her husband's garden. They'll live on forever.
And the origin of the neon signs, these are the paint tubes.
Yeah, the paint tube neon. Al Blankshein did those for us, and they were designed in the 80s, and they were originally meant to fit into the windows at our store on Blue Mound. There are two singles. The singles are coming home with me. I don't have enough room for a big four-piece one. My sister and her husband will probably take a couple of the other ones, and we've had a lot of people that were interested in purchasing them, so we're looking at, you know, working with that. But those also had been in some design, big design shows nationally too. And they're spectacular. I mean, I cannot, as long as we've had them, when I'm here at night and the lights are off in the store and I walk through the store, it's just amazing to me to see how fabulously beautiful they are.
I know it's not the same, but are people taking pictures of this place before it goes away?
Yes, they are. And we gave out a Valentine card to people that came in on Valentine's Day of a picture of part of the neon signs that said, we love our customers, you know, Artist and Display Valentine's 2015. Yeah, because they've been around. I mean, they've been a part of us for so long. I think sometimes because you just know you love them that you forget how special they are to other people. But those neons are unbelievably amazing.
The neon sign accepted
Would you imagine that someday stores like this will come back into vogue?
I would hope so. I think we talked about this before, everything usually comes around, and I imagine at some point someone will say, oh my gosh, I just went into a store where I could actually see things and touch it, and there were some really unusual things, and hopefully that will come around again, because I think there are still a lot of people out there that love shopping, and they love the experience of finding things, finding unique, unusual things, and being able to touch it. One of our customers that comes in a lot on our Saturday and Sunday demonstrations had said, her granddaughter said to her, well, you can just buy your art supply stores anywhere. You could buy them online. And she said, no, you don't understand. Artist on Display was the Cheers of art supply stores. They knew my name when I came in. They talked to me about new products that I would love, that they, you know, they were going to the shows and they picked this out for me. And it's just things like that that become very personal, because I know we love to shop. And our customers love to shop. And that's also one of the reasons why we had great decorations for holidays. A woman came in and she said, you know, every Christmas and every Halloween, I think of Artist on Display because my house is decorated with items from Artist on Display.
Well, so in a way, Artist Display, the store, might be closing, but the impact of Artist on Display will live on.
Oh, and what else is going to live on is all of the wonderful display pieces that we had, Italian design chairs and tables from Italy that people are buying. So as they sit at their kitchen table with our chairs, they'll remember Artist on Display. And so many people have come in and said that they wanted a piece to remind them of the great times that they always had shopping here and what a wonderful store we were.
Well, I am certain the community will miss you, and at the same time, I wish you best of luck in everything you do in retirement, and thank you so much for sharing this story with us.
Oh, thank you for taking the time. We know our store is very special, and it's a good way for us to say goodbye to our customers, but we'll still see them in the community. As I've talked to people, I said, you know, you used to see me as Artist on Display. Now you'll see me as just artist in the community.
Nora Hackenberg is creative director at Artist on Display, an art supply store on Milwaukee's far west side that will be closing its doors in mid-March after serving professional and amateur artists since 1936. You can find pictures of the iconic outdoor sign and the neon paint tubes at WUWM.com. That is Wednesday's edition of Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in. And also, thanks to so many of you for playing a role in our successful Winter On Air membership drive. If you've already become a member or renewed your membership, thanks. You can still do it even though the drive is over. You can find out how at WUWM.com/give. Meanwhile, I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Keep listening. We're about an hour away from the latest news headlines from NPR and WBUR in Boston on Here and Now. But right now, it's 11 o'clock and fresh air is next.